The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right. So, we'll go ahead and just jump right on and get started. The impetus for this talk is obviously, you know, world events over the last year has created a sort of a renewed interest in Iran, understanding Iran, understanding its politics, its place in the world, and its relationship to the United States. Recently, people are aware, back in December, January, there was a wave of mass sort of demonstrations that took place in Iran, spread out throughout the country. Something like 70-some-odd cities experienced some wave or some degree of demonstrations that took place, mostly a very young milieu of activists that were involved with that, but very, very deep and very broad in terms of the grievances that were at stake that caused the sort of outpouring of activity at that time. And obviously, in addition to that, has been the election of Donald Trump in this country and the sort of path of American foreign policy that he has undertaken in that time, which has very clearly put Iran in the crosshairs for the better part of his administration. And that process has obviously been accelerated over the last few months with Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal, as it's better known. So all of these things, these factors, have caused sort of a renewed interest in Iran, but Iran is a sort of a very difficult, bit of a conundrum of a country, of a society, of a history for people to really get their heads around, because it's really incredibly misunderstood, I think, from my experience in terms of having conversations with people, whether they're involved in the field or if they're activists or from whatever approach. And I think largely this has to do with, you know, one, living in the United States. You're living in the primary, you know, in the belly of the beast of the primary antagonist with Iran over the course of the last, 40 years, at least since the Iranian Revolution. And so there's a specific narrative that is taught and retaught and socialized and confirmed, and nothing outside of that sort of limited narrative is actually on offer. So people get a sort of obfuscated view and understanding of Iran and its place in the world living in this society. And at the same time, the Iranian regime itself has an interest in maintaining that level of obfuscation and understanding of what that regime is about for people outside of it, because it also has a narrative that it would like to advance in terms of its legitimation, its place in that society, and its level of control. And so there is a giant disconnect between, you know, the image and the reality of what Iran is. And so that massive disconnect that exists leads to a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of, you know, inability to actually, you know, be able to have an analysis that has explanatory power in a way that we as socialists, people who want to see a better world, can actually be able to understand and then to be able to convey. And so, I'll state from the outset, Iran is a labyrinth. I mean, it's a very complicated, complex political and social system. It has been for a very, very long time. I liken it this way. I'll ask people, do you consider yourself to be American? Okay, how far back do you consider your history and your lineage? You know, some people, you know, if some people will say to the Revolutionary War, some people sooner, right? Because this is a nation of immigrants, of people who come here. And so people's span of time and concept of time is a very short, you know, at most, what, 200, 300 years? You would, and then beyond that, it's maybe European history of some form or fashion. You know, you ask that of an Iranian, and you're talking about a few centuries of history and identity that is wrapped up in that, that is very complicated, that is very complex. And there's really, I don't think, a real definition or an agreed upon conception of what it actually means to be Iranian, because part of that is, you know, identity is a modern phenomenon, right? It's a phenomenon of the nation state and the creation of identity, the creation of common language, of history, of these things. This is a modern phenomenon of capitalism and the rise of the nation state and its needs. And so, you know, looking from that lens and understanding the world we understand now this way, and looking back at a society like Iran, it again also doesn't have a lot of explanatory power, but it does in a certain sense, because Iranians now do have a sense of identity and a sense of a place in the world and so forth. And large part of that is because it's been shaped by Iran's modern history since the, you know, sort of the advent of capitalism and imperialism and its interactions with the world. So that's one element, and I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But just to step back again to the question of image and reality, it's important to sort of step back and actually kind of understand Iran a little bit in terms of, you know, what was the revolution, what did it mean, what were its impacts on society? Because, you know, from this perspective here, you know, you say Iran and, you know, the thing that comes to mind is, you know, Khomeini, Khamenei, clerics, people with turbans, a repressive society, you know, certain notions come to mind when you think of Iran, and much in a very real sense, a sort of an identity as maybe a backwardness, right? There's a backward society. It's very primitive, maybe in its economic development and so forth. And nothing could actually be further from the truth. Iran is an incredibly dynamic society, economically, socially, so on and so forth. You know, just some demographic information. I believe Iran is like the 18th largest country in the world by population size, by geographic size, economically, in terms of its, you know, GDP, if we want to use those types of information. It's actually, and the, you know, you figure there's what, over 160 countries in the world, that puts it on the upper, you know, on the sort of the larger groups of nations in terms of that regard. So Iran is a very sizable place and a very large population. And so that's one element of it that is often misleading. Another is the demographic shifts that have taken place within Iran since the revolution, because people think of the revolution as a very backward thing, and that, you know, people view Islam in very, you know, Islamophobic, backward sorts of ways. And so how do you reconcile image and reality when before the revolution, literacy rates in Iran for women stood at 35% in 1976, rose to 52% in 1986, and today stand around over 80% of the population. That's female literacy rate. So you could see that the revolution was incredibly progressive in certain outcomes. General literacy rates in the country have gone from under 40% to over 85% right now in general for the population as a whole. Women in Iranian society, which we often think of as an incredibly repressive patriarchal society, which it is, right? But at the same time, a contradiction exists that more than half the college over half the college students in Iran are women. As to believe 55% of university students are women in that society, yet they represent only 20% of the labor force. So again, a massive contradiction, a huge improvement versus what existed prior to the revolution. And so these types of sort of demographic challenges to the notion of what is Iran and what kind of a society and what is the Islamic Republic and what are all those things, these are, you know, these are contradictions that exist within that society. So I'm going to jump ahead and we'll get moving into other aspects of it. So what is the Islamic Republic of Iran? What does it mean to be Iranian? And what is Iran? And so here's where I'm going to jump back into the question of identity for people, because for Iran, its modern identity is largely the outcome of its interaction with imperial forces of Europe, largely manifesting in the late 18th and 19th century. Is that right? No, 18th and 19th century, going into the 20th century, and the notion of identity is vis-a-vis, you know, the other that is coming, that is, you know, has imperial ambitions for the region, so on and so forth. And so the interesting thing about Iran is Iran was never actually a colonial nation. It was never colonial. It was never occupied by an imperial power in the establishment of a colonial regime, a la, you know, India, for example, and sort of the British Empire, or sort of a number of other countries can be, or Egypt, right? A number of countries can be used as an example. Iran was never a colonized country, but it was still subject to the dictates and the pressures of imperialism. And so the Iranian identity that develops in terms of understanding the people themselves vis-a-vis the outside force is largely shaped by this dynamic. And so being a non-colonial nation, but yet being subject to the dictates of colonialism, Iranians largely begin to differentiate and begin to understand themselves and their place in the world, and really trying to understand why is it that we are now a quasi-subjected people versus the encroaching colonialism. And sort of a development of an idea, development of identity comes out of this. And so people see, well, weakness in government, so on and so forth. And so from a very early stage, there is pressure from below on the government for reform, for changes, to not be so subjected to the whims of outside powers. And so the Qajar era, which was the era before the Pahlavi dynasty took place in the 1920s, was a very weak centralized government in Iran. And so it was in the habit of making massive concessions to European powers over its territorial integrity, its administration of the state, its economy, so on and so forth. And that dislocation, those things caused upheavals. They caused disruptions from below. And so people would push back against that. And within that pushback meant that, well, wait a second, this is disrupting our lives, we need a better administration, we need government that can stand up to this. And sort of that dynamic played out to a lot of movements from below to be able to challenge this sort of new reality that was being imposed on Iran. And so what you see from that era onward is social mobilization from below to effectuate change, to put pressure on government. And so you begin to see, and what I would like to think of as a movement for democracy within Iran and understanding itself and what political power is and what type of political power is necessary, emerging in the early part of the 20th century. And so things like the Constitutional Revolution are important because it's the first revolution of that sort in the Middle East, in which there's an actual push for accountability, a constitutional monarchy, a system of representative government. The first majlis, the first parliament in the Middle East is developed. And so this begins the sort of the dynamic from push from below with response from above and sort of the shaping of society. And so from that point on, if there's anything that can be gleaned in Iranian society, is that social mobilization, social forces from below begin to actually play a prominent part in the development of Iranian society and politics. And then if you fast forward again to the next major confrontation, you know, is after the Second World War, and when there's a wave of, you know, sort of the post-colonial movements, the anti-colonial movements that take over, you know, that erupt around the world, Iran has finds itself within that milieu as well. So understanding the Mossadegh era, the CIA MI6 coup against the democratically elected government, you can't understand that outside of the concept of what was happening in the world around Iran, right? This is time of the rise of Nasser in Egypt, Nehru, Lumumba, you know, third world nationalist movements. Iran finds itself within that milieu as well. Again, pushes from below as well, because this is about representative government. What does it mean? Accountability, things like that. But social mobilization plays an incredible part during the Mossadegh era. In fact, the first coup attempt fails because of a mass mobilization from below to actually defend Mossad death, but then ultimately the coup is successful because the forces that are at the head of that mobilization largely retreat from the defense of Mossad death, and so that's able to fall. So I won't spend a lot of time. So questions again. Identity is about internal politics, the development of it, where people see themselves, sort of people power mobilizations from below. Again, economically, Iran is being incorporated into world capitalism. Its main export is oil. It has, you know, again, it's an integral part of the world system. And so this sort of Iranian identity around the question of democracy and power and representation, I want to establish that from the get-go as like sort of an arc that exists in the society. And so in the post-Mossadegh era, you have the Pahlavi dynasty, Mohammad Reza Shah, and you have an economic development model, which is very top-down, state-led type of development, sort of the development of a sort of nepotistic bourgeoisie. Again, the expansion of the industrial sector, larger working class coming onto the scene, economic development, but it's also very uneven. And so at the same time, you have half the population living in outside of the major cities, and then you begin to see a massive influx of the population into the cities as a result of some of the sort of reform or you know, the Shah's white revolution development from the top coming down, which then causes a series of dislocations and so on and so forth. So you know, these dislocations, this top-down development, this top-down sort of politics begins to butt heads with people's expectations, right? There's a growing city, there's growing unrest, the economy is developing in fits and starts, politically there's nepotism, people feel like they're outside of it, old social classes are being disrupted, what were the old landed elite, the clergy, so on and so forth, are losing their power vis-a-vis this sort of new nascent bourgeoisie around the Shah. And so you begin to see the mobilization of people power beginning in the late 60s, going down, being defeated, and then erupting again in the mid-70s, pushing back against a sort of top-down state-led development that is largely leaving the mass of the population behind. And so that's when we come up to the Iranian Revolution itself in 1979. And again, this is where I think questions of identity, of people's place in society, how they view themselves, and their demands and expectations of government are incredibly important. And ideology actually matters, right? We've got a number of social movements. There's an emerging workers' movements. There's strike activity on a very high level taking place in Iran. There are movements of national minorities within Iran. A number of things are pushing up against the Shah's regime. But also ideology is important because, you know, the other thing that's important to consider is what shaped the form of those movements going into the revolution and then shaped the revolution itself afterwards. And there are two main threads that have actually, that were part and parcel of that. And that is, one is a sort of variant of Marxism, if you will, and then the other is Islamism, right? Islamic fundamentalism that was led by the clergy. And sort of the Marxism that existed at the time was, you know, a Marxism that was dominated by Stalinism, dominated by third world nationalism, Maoism, you know, Guevarism, that sort of substitutionist type of Marxism that saw the world in a very top-down sort of way, that we will carry on a revolution for you rather than mobilize and activate a whole layer of people. And so the Marxist circles that existed at that time were either the Tudeh Party, which was, you know, a shell of itself leading up to the revolution, largely discredited during the Mossadegh era, and then a new wave of sort of Marxist guerrilla organizations like the Fedayeen or the Mujahideen, who actually blended elements of Islamism and Marxism. And why did they blend elements of Islamism and sort of third world Maoism, Marxism together? And this largely had to do with the politics of Ali Shariati. And Shariati was sort of a lay person, educated in Western circles, but came from sort of a lay clergy family, was very interested and influenced by Third World Nationalist Movement, was a follower of Fanon, of religious understanding like Massignon, who in the Catholic Church was sort of very much interested in Islamism, Islam as a religion. And so he sought to blend sort of, this ideology of liberation within sort of a language that people could understand, which is Islam, but at the same time have it be an emancipatory type of ideology. And he found within Shi'i Islam this notion of, an emancipatory language that he carried on to the masses. And it was wildly popular and it resonated with people because largely there was a discrediting of the left in Iran, right? The politics of the Two-Day Party, the Stalinists, and so forth, didn't really give much in terms of a way forward for people. So people were very much drawn to this sort of blending ideology that felt like it was very organic to that society itself. And so the Fedayeen, the Mujahideen, these organizations fled to and grew out of this movement that Shariati, in opposition to the Shah in terms of a renewal of society. Then the others who were participants in the revolution were the clergy, Khomeini, right? Khomeini from afar because after 1963, when the Shah implements his white revolution, Khomeini is a very vocal critic of the regime. He has to flee the country, goes to Iraq. He has a sort of a reputation of being, sort of anti-empire, so on and so forth, that he develops over time. But the real kernel of the intellectual, ideological force of the revolution itself was Shariati. And so Khomeini and his clerical establishment, his clerical coterie, largely tailed that aspect of it and didn't really contradict in terms of their vision of what a future Iranian society would look like and what they would like to implement, and largely adopted, in addition to Shariati's themes, a certain level of anti-imperialism. And again, you see this theme coming back, the question of Persian identity, Iranian identity, is vis-a-vis the outside influence that they're constantly have to bombard, right? The memory of Mossadegh and the overthrow of our democratically elected government is very deep-seated, and so there's always a distrust of the foreign. And so the Shah's relationship with the United States, with Western powers, are things that cause it a great level of mistrust. And so the door was largely open for these forces to develop and ideologically push forward the revolution as it began to take place in the late 70s. But there are social forces involved. It's not just ideology and mobilizing this handful of people or that handful of people. The revolution itself, I can't go into a ton of detail. Go listen to my talk from a couple of years ago. It's on We Are Many. Goes into this a little bit more detail. But the idea is the Iranian revolution as a mass event is probably one of the largest in world history. It mobilized roughly 10% of the population, which at the time is about 4 million people. I mean, that's 4 million people who were actively involved in the process of revolution over a period of about 4 years. That's more than the Russian Revolution, that's more than the German Revolution, that's more than the people who were in Tahrir Square during the Arab, you understand, you get a sense of size and scope that as a mass event, it was probably the largest in history. And its influence obviously still reverberates to this day, and so that's why it's incredibly important. But there was a wide variety of social forces that are involved in that. There's the student movement, there's the women's movement, there's the clerical establishment, there's the workers themselves in various industries that are all involved, as well as the Marxist guerrilla forces and, so on and so forth, that are all part of this. And so this is a giant mass of humanity that burst onto the scene and isn't going to go away, and ultimately it led to the toppling of the regime. But while all those things, all those forces could agree on what they were against, a vision of what is the society you're trying to implement is the thing that always was the element of elusiveness, and those who were able to position themselves in a place to actually be able to take over the revolution and consolidate rule were the clergy. And they were able to do so largely because of their position in society and their actual network. right? This is incredibly important to understand. In a revolutionary situation, the best organized usually succeed. And that should be like the first thing people should understand about revolution. And so who were the best organized amongst the revolutionary? Well, it was the clerical elite, right? The coterie around Khomeini. What did he do? Immediately upon entering Iran during the course of the revolution, he began setting up parallel state government, parallel establishments. There a whole new a parallel structure of power, a dual power, if you will, at the same time, and began occupying it with people that were in his immediate circle. The other elements of the revolution outside of that, organized-wise, were in the streets, right? In the communities, in the neighborhoods, these things called comités, right? The committees of the defenders of the revolution against the Shah's forces and the forces of reaction. So this was an independent body, not necessarily coordinated, but an independent body, an independent source of power within the revolution that clerical establishment had to contend with. And then the other was obviously the movement in the factories, the thing that ultimately led to the crash of the Shah's regime, which was the Shura movement, right? Factory occupations, factory organization, the bringing of the economy to a standstill. This was the last source of sort of independent power. Now, while the sort of the guerrilla forces were integral in terms of the street battles and the final defeat of the Shah's forces, playing an independent role and playing of sufficient size and organization to be able to participate in a meaningful way in any of those centers of power, they did not. Right? So where socialists argue about workplace and workers taking over society, this brand of Marxism, you know, perverted sense of Marxism, Maoism, Stalinism, and so forth, actually left that entire element of people power unto itself. And so they largely stayed away, focused on sort of what you know, guerrilla movements end up doing, which is, you know, the deed, the task, only a handful of, you know, cadre are necessary to take out this battle, and they largely left these two sources of independent power relegated it. And so, of course, the clerical establishment very quickly filled that vacuum by sending in folks loyal to it and largely were able to co-opt and take over the Shuras and Islamicize them, the Comites and Islamicize them, use their parallel institutions to begin to infiltrate these things and actually begin the process of consolidation. Although I make it sound very simple, this took place over a period of years. And then the final nail in the coffin was the embassy occupation in Tehran when the students went and took over the embassy. This actually caused a schism between the sort of the revolutionaries, the radicals. The left largely left that coalition with Khomeini. That caused their split, which then allowed them to be isolated in Khomeini and the clerical establishment to you know, basically round them up, force them out of the country, and so forth, and actually led to a very sharp, at that point, the acceleration of consolidation, and then the Iran-Iraq War, which started shortly thereafter, was the final sort of consolidated moment. So there's that element of it. So now you have, we're up to the revolution, the post-revolution, and now it's a question of the development of state. Because all of a sudden you had a revolutionary process that unleashed 4 million people onto the street, actively engaged with the creation of a new society. But that also creates expectations, right? People who are involved in revolution don't necessarily give up their expectation that quickly in any sort of way. And so there is a process that begins to unfold for consolidation to actually be effective over a period of time. But the other notable fact is what I just alluded to a moment ago, which is the sort of parallel state that Khomeini established through his clerical establishment. So you have the existing state that they took over, right, which consisted of a parliament, a representative entity, a sort of a elected body, and then at the same time you had parallel institutions that the clerical establishment erected through the imposition of dual power, when the question of dual power was at stake. But those institutions didn't go away. In fact, the clerics held on to it. And the emerging state, and since the revolution up through today, has been this sort of uneasy relationship between these dual centers of power that exist in the country. And so that's why it's a contradiction. It seems like a contradiction in terms to say that there's an Islamic Republic in Iran, because on the one hand, the Islamic is very concretely in this position of the parallel state, and the Republic is this element of the actual state, which is an elected institution, right? We have a parliament. They have existing elections, albeit limited. Those things exist. And so there is this contradiction at the heart of the Iranian state that has been actually a site of contestation for the entirety of the Islamic Republic. And so that's the core of the understanding of sort of the fight between the left and the right, Islamists in power, the principalists, the reformists, the conservative factions. These factional politics represent where does power actually exist at the top of society, right? At the same time, because of the popular nature of the Islamic of the revolution itself, the Islamic Republic actually had to, and I don't want to say had to pay lip service, had to actually provide the reforms and the demands and meet at least the segment of the demands of the population. And so, one thing I want to read for you is just a couple of excerpts from the emerging constitution that came out of Iran. This is the founding document of the Islamic Republic. So this is like Article 31. So under the government's purview, these are the things that they have to do: the provision of basic necessity to all citizens, housing, food, clothing, hygiene, medical treatment, education, and the necessary facilities for the establishment of a family. Preventing the exploitation of another's labor. Prevention of foreign economic domination over the country's economy. So on and so forth. Again, all these are very progressive elements in the constitution that came out because of the social forces, the recognition of the social forces that were involved in the revolution and the demands of the revolution. And so there is a sort of track that the government has to then take in terms of economic development, which is the creation of a welfare state, right? Iran becomes, in essence, a welfare state. So the mass inequality that existed before the revolution, that gap begins to tighten after the revolution. And what do I mean by that? That is the provision of basic services. That is not a sort of a leveling of the playing field is what the Islamic Republic undertook. And so what does that mean? Before the revolution, there's a massive divide between urban and rural in terms of population resources, provision of services, so on and so forth. During the revolution, after the revolution itself, immediately what takes place is a closing of that gap. That is, there was an eightfold increase in the number of roads that were created in rural areas, the electrification of rural areas, the provision of basic health care in rural areas, so that the things like child morbidity, life expectancy, preventable diseases, all of these things actually came up to basically first world standards across the country as a whole, right? That is a massive accomplishment for a country that is mired in a war for 8 years and under isolation economically, right? This is what it meant for the Republic to gain legitimacy in the eyes of its population, was it had to actually deliver. But at the same time as it raised sort of the floor, it meant that privation and rationing of the resources that existed actually pushed everybody else down as well. And so, there's a famous saying that they shared the poverty during the era of the Iran-Iraq War. But there was a certain sense of shared sacrifice in that as well, and sort of an identity that developed under those conditions. But Iran was a capitalist country before the revolution, and it was a capitalist country after the revolution. And so, in terms of the dynamics of the economy, the relations of social production take place remain largely the same. Under the Pahlavi regime, again, top-down economic development from the state after the revolution, top-down economic development by the state. But now the state owns everything, you know, because mostly the bourgeoisie had fled the country with what they had. They all live in Los Angeles now. I joke, large numbers of them do. And so now the state becomes the owner of industry, the owner of the means of production en masse. And so because of that, they're able to deliver on some of these, you know, the provisions of the sort of emerging welfare state. But also, economic control becomes very top-down, state-centric. So it's actually accurate to describe Iran after the revolution as a state capitalist, developmentalist state in terms of its economic development. And of course, the people who dominate the state in the early years of the revolution are the clerical establishment and largely lay people, because many people with expertise fled the country during the revolution or shortly thereafter. And so, you know, the question of management, mismanagement, technocratic management of the economy is largely uneven. It's all over the place because some of these folks are trained, some of them aren't. And the ability to actually run a modern society. But the idea that you had to maintain a basic minimal existence for the population as your source of legitimation in society and the legitimacy of the government, that was a constant, and it's constantly been there. Now, what happens after the end of the war is that Iran then has to realize, like, okay, well, you know, things have to change. We have to develop economically because, one, we have a growing population, right? There's a short baby boom that took place right after the revolution. You know, baby booms exist after a revolution because people are excited for prospects of the future. And so people come together, have families. And so for a brief period of time in the early part of the revolution, there is actually a baby boom, but then shortly drops off. So Iran's birth rate is actually quite low. I think it's 1.2 per family at this point, which is on par with the United States. So Iran's population is largely stabilized and will hit a peak of about 100 million, I think, in the next 15 years, and then will slowly decrease after that. Okay, great, time-wise. So then the question is, how do we develop? Because the models they've been using haven't been working. And so, you know, this is coming out in 1988-89. Rafsanjani is now the president. The war is over. How does Iran reintegrate itself into the world? Because at this point, you're talking about, you know, this is the beginning of the end of the Soviet bloc of Eastern Europe, of the other model of state-led development. And all that remains is, you know, in the words of Margaret Thatcher, you know, is liberal economics, neoliberal economics, right? There is no alternative. So if state-led development isn't the way, then the process has to be, well, we need to liberalize the economy. Okay, so that means the state has to begin to sell off its resources, integrate, and find some way to integrate into the world economy. And so it begins this process. But again, there's a contradiction, because at the heart of the state, there's two state structures. There's the existing state and the parallel state. And so the process of privatization meant that the state sells off its industries to the only willing buyer, which is the parallel state, which is run by the clerical establishment. And so then you begin to see a process over the last 20 plus years in which the role in the economy has been moved away from the state, although the state is still a dominant player in the economy. But it's not like there's a nascent bourgeoisie that's actually developing itself. What it is those, the nepotism, the cronyism of the clerical establishment in the parallel state that is taking over these things. And so that's why you see institutions like the Revolutionary Guard Corps now represent something like 35% of the economic activity of Iran. That's significant. This is an institution of the parallel state. And at the same time as this sort of economic liberalization is taking place, there's a push because state resources are dwindling, oil revenues go down, and so it puts pressure on the welfare state and the ability to deliver for people. And so there's a contradiction there because there's people's rising expectations. Well, now that the war's over, improvements, we're now educated, we want access, we want improvements in our life, and then the inability of the state to actually be able to deliver on a number of those things. And so that creates a lot of tension at the top of society. And so the way to understand what the factional battles within Iran are actually about, it's about the determination of the future of the economic development of Iran, right? There's one group, you know, who came to be known as the reformists, who said you know, we need to ditch sort of, you know, the emphasis on Islamic identity and actually focus on the economy and reintegrate Iran in a very substantial way into the world economy again. That's what Khatami represented, the sort of the thawing, the sort of the dialogue of civilizations that he was advancing at that time, was an ability to be able to do that. But then, of course, 9/11 happens and Iran becomes part of the axis of evil. And so then what we get is a reactionary president who comes to power in Ahmadinejad, who is sort of the right wing reaction that says no, we can't reintegrate into the world economy, more autarkic, representing the elements of the right wing of the clerical establishment who want internal control, so on and so forth. And so this is the tension that continues to play out. But the reality is that welfare state that the Iranian revolution created and has maintained over a period of time, even to this day, despite changes to that. That is the elimination of subsidies, the handing out of cash payments versus subsidized food and so on and so forth, has meant that within Iran, a new contradiction from below exists. That is, you now have a population that is overwhelmingly under 30, that is highly educated, has an incredible sense of self in terms of identity, its place in the world, where it aspires to be versus what limitations are put on it by the regime. And these are the contradictions that are playing out right now. Those are the things, those pressures, right? If you went to school and you got your degree and then you went and got your master's and your PhD and you're driving a taxi or looking for work, the reality of the world of your expectations versus the reality of the world as it is are coming heads up. And who do you blame? It's the society, it's the people at the very top who are mismanaging that political system, who are mismanaging that economy, who begin to take the ire of the population from below. And so that's the dynamic that is unfolded at this moment in Iran. At the same time, it's still unfolding amongst its political class. It is an unsettled question, right? When I say there is a, you know, the Islamic Republic is a contradiction in terms. Which is it going to be? Is it clerical rule on the parallel state that governs what happens in Iran, or is it the elected government of Iran, no matter how limited in who can run and on what terms and so on and so forth? And even those who occupy the offices of the elected government, the Rafsanjanis, the Khatamis, the Ahmadinejads, and the Rouhani, are constantly battling with the unelected, unaccountable parallel state. That's the dynamic that continues to take place. And so hopefully what I've been able to accomplish, what I set out to do a little bit, is to actually folks to understand where this dynamic from below is coming from, but also to understand this dynamic from above. Iran is a contested space and has been since the revolution, and there is no telling where that process will unfold and how it will unfold. But the important thing to understand is that process is unfolding, right? That where it goes and how it takes, I can't prognosticate. I can't tell you where that goes. But the important thing to understand is that outside forces, outside politics, obviously influence that, right? On the one hand, you had the pressure from below and internal that said, after the war, we have to reintegrate. We have to relax sort of this sort of top-down over control of society and open up to the world. Less emphasis on Islam, more emphasis on reintegration, right? That comes to a standstill. Why? Because of 9/11. Because of the reorientation of U.S. imperial policy in the Middle East and Iran's role within that. And so then it begins to shift. And so you can see outside pressure, right? The identity that has existed for the better part of the last 200 years is we're constantly besieged by the outside. And so that forces internal dynamics in different directions. So who knows where we end up now with Trump's scrapping of the nuclear deal. And the fervent from below, who knows, this is kind of like a powder keg waiting to explode at any point in time, and there's no real telling which way it goes. But it's a dynamic that is continually unfolding. And that's why I called this Iran's unfinished revolution, was because the process of revolution that took place in 1978 through 79, 81, 82, this whole process is still unfolding. It is yet to be finalized in any real way, shape, or form, because the forces from the bottom and the forces at the top are still fighting it out over what it actually means to be the Islamic Republic of Iran, or whether that's even what we want anymore. So I think I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.